The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
I saw a pale horse,
a beast.
We're told in the Book of Revelation.
This is not a human child.
Isn't an angel?
Satan!
Armageddon is almost upon us.
Order the use of nuclear weapons.
The world is a fine place and worth fighting for.
From one end of the world to the other, I will oppose you.
They're here.
Welcome to the end of the world.
Wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. This is PID Radio.
From the heartland of America, I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, and welcome to our humble bunker, everybody. Let's see, what's today?
Today is
the 17th.
That's right. Of February 2013. And
17th of fill in the blank. We just, you know, we want to be relevant no matter what the month is.
That's right. So whenever or wherever you're listening to us, thank you for inviting us inside your portable electronic device. And we have 93 years until the end of the world.
93 years?
Yes.
Oh, I'm going to relax. How do we know that?
Well, it depends on who you ask, of course. There are some who say it'll happen imminently, I thought this was appropriate. In the wake of the spectacular meteorite display over Russia, and tragically, a number of people hurt, some seriously, in the Siberian region of Russia, we did dodge the bullet that DA 2012 or 2014, whatever that asteroid was.
Asteroid 2012, DA 14.
Okay, that swung through inside the orbit of some orbits of some of our communication satellites. So there was some question as to whether the asteroid would take out some of our, telephone service or possibly GPS satellites. But that didn't happen. But we are told now by experts that an asteroid is supposed to hit the Earth in 2106.
Which one is that? Is that Patatus?
No.
Apophis or?
You say Patatus and I say potatoes. 2012 YQ1, which will in all likelihood crash into Earth, but not until 2016.
So is it DA-14's cousin?
Well, I'm not sure, actually.
Do they know each other at all?
Now, I'm looking at the source on this just to make sure that this isn't like, Sorsha Fall or something. But it quotes, and I'm doing that because it does quote Russian experts. That always goes, sources inside the Kremlin telling
today,
Vladimir Putin that. According to the source, Russian astronomers Andrei Oreshko and Timur Kryachko discovered 2012 YQ1, which... according to Kryachko, if the asteroid's course is not altered by a random collision with another celestial body or similarly unpredictable circumstance in January of 2106, just in time for my, 140th birthday, 150th birthday, something, the asteroid will pass through a gravitational keyhole, bringing it as close as 1.5 moon distances to Earth, near enough for Earth's gravity to change the asteroid's course and draw it even closer. Ultimately, YQ1 will hit Earth so hard that a global catastrophe will be unavoidable. Scientists estimate the impact could equate to the energy released by approximately 25,000 atomic bombs going off at once.
That's a lot.
This puts YQ1 on par with the infamous Apophis, which measures 270 meters, which is, roughly 600 feet in diameter, and has been thought likely to strike the Earth in 2036.
So, who's going to win?
I don't know. It's a race. this is from the source, by the way, is The Voice of Russia, which appears to be a legitimate news site, but...
Yeah, we'll do more research on that.
Yeah, 2012 YQ1.
So my question is it that big that... Because the truth is, the AD-14 came closer than that.
It did, but AD-14 was only...
It was pretty little.
Yeah,
teeny. It was only about 150 feet across.
So...
size does matter. when it comes to your asteroids... Oh, sorry.
Sorry, kind of splattered the vocal there on that one. Back slowly away. Let me turn up the earphones just a little bit there. Okay.
Thank you. I don't yell when you have my ears up.
2012 YQ1 is an Apollo asteroid discovered on 19 December 2012 by astronomers Andrei Oreshko and Timur Kryachko using an ELENA telescope located in the Chilean Atacama Desert down in Chile. So anyway, so one of those near Earth objects, one of those NEOs that we keep hearing about.
Yeah.
So anyway, but we've got another 93 years to worry about. So that would make it my 144th birthday. So I don't have to worry too much about it, I guess.
You'll be a head in a jar.
Yep.
And I'll be right there.
I'm betting 20 quatloos that it doesn't hit.
Sam, we've only been going for 5 minutes. Yeah, well, it's a disastrous show.
That's right. Starting off with doom right off the top of the bat. Right off the bat. Well, anyway, it was quite a display in Russia, and I thought it was kind of curious that almost immediately astronomers were saying this has nothing to do with the asteroid that was coming by.
Well, what I find really curious today is that we're getting stories of a fireball that was seen in California, actually a little bit before the one in Russia, mm-hmm. same day, mm-hmm. and one in Cuba. And some scientists are saying, well, you know what? They may actually be related to, you know, DA-14.
Hmm. Well, at least it'll give the folks at some of the online doom sites stuff to talk about for a while.
Yeah, it was getting pretty boring.
Getting pretty boring. Also, by the way, if you're interested in astronomical phenomena, from the Daily Mail, a giant gas cloud at the center of the Milky Way is going to be sucked into the black hole at the center of the galaxy, and we should be able to see that later in the year.
Say that again? Giant dust cloud?
A giant gas cloud will hit the massive black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, our galaxy, later this year, according to astronomers. It's supposed to be visible come fall, September, October.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if we'll be able to see it, but at least guys with the proper equipment will see it. You know, guys who can view, you know, in the X-ray portion of the spectrum.
Hey, here's the question. If what I know about black holes, you can fit into a black hole. Isn't there an event horizon at a black hole so that if you are observing from this side, mm-hmm. you never really see the object go in?
True, at least within certain wavelengths. They would be looking at, like I said, in the X-ray portion of the X-ray wavelengths. Yeah. The cloud is glowing under strong ultraviolet radiation from the hot stars around the center of the galaxy. You know, those that are kind of caught in the orbit of the black hole or orbiting the black hole. So anyway.
Is there a blue box in there?
Quite possibly, yes. Actually, a small metallic dog floating there holding everything together. Doctor Who reference for you there. Just for you, Dean. So, kind of an interesting phenomenon. And I know scientists will look at things like this and start postulating on how this relates to the formation of the Big Bang and so forth. As Christians, we just look at this and say, you know, this just...
what a cool design.
What a cool design. Yeah. Awesome design.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Way to go, Lord. But Jesus also told us to look not just to appreciate his handiwork, but also to look for signs of what may be coming. There mm-hmm. will be signs, you know, in the heavens.
Yeah. And so when we see the things like that occurred over Russia this past week, I mean, you know, what significance do we attach to that?
You know, I honestly don't know, yeah. But I do know that things like that are very rare.
Mm-hmm.
What I found interesting is that once again, it's Siberia, isn't Tunguska in Siberia?
Right.
What does the universe have against Russia? Let's hit him again. Yeah. Let's see. We hit him in 17? No, when was it? Tunguska. Was it 1907? Early 20th century.
Yeah, let me check that real quick. I did see a couple of articles that referenced the Tunguska meteorite in describing what happened in Siberia this time around.
One of them, I don't know if you saw this one, but I'm betting you did, that the blast was equivalent to, what did I see, about 30 Hiroshimas?
Yeah, something like that.
That's pretty big.
Mm-hmm. It is. And it makes you, you know...
And how can that not be related? I mean, they didn't see this coming. We're so busy looking at DA-14 for the last year. We didn't see this coming. Oh, look. Yeah, where did that come from?
As you said, it was really teeny. It was, not.
But it was moving very, very quickly.
And according to astronomers, it came from a different direction than DA14, which is why astronomers were so quick to say this had nothing to do with DA14.
Yeah.
There's about one or two of these that hit Earth every day. It's just most of the Earth is not inhabited. Middle of the ocean, desert area. There are lots of places where these things can hit where people just don't see them. Tunguska was 1908, June 30th of 1908.
You know, bearing that in mind, what you just said, that science, and scientists do say things like that all the time. Well, these things occur most of the time in uninhabited areas. And yes, they occur, many, many times a day. So what you're saying is there aren't that many people on Earth?
No, I realize
what you're saying. But if there aren't that many areas that are inhabited, if the majority of the Earth is uninhabited, and I know this includes the ocean.
The oceans, right.
But there are lots of areas where it hits over land.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah, I just think science often talks. They it's almost like they have two heads or two mouths.
Yeah, they want to have it both ways.
Yeah.
Let's see. This was 20, YQ1, doing a search here. YQ1 was taken off the impact risk table by the JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So the Russian news source may be running with something that isn't quite accurate, or at least the majority of scientists haven't bought into it yet. So the Jet Propulsion Laboratory runs their NEO program, Near Earth Object Program, which tracks these small bodies floating through the solar system that might come close enough to Earth to pose a risk. And again, in December, it was actually removed from the risk table. So there is, according to JPL, which is a division of NASA, no impact risk from 2012 YQ1. So I guess
no soup for you.
Yes. So I guess come 2106, I can just enjoy a nice, quiet 144th birthday.
Yeah, honey. We'll bake a big cake that year.
Yeah.
You know, I did a search right now on Google for 2012 YQ1 and get lots of hits, but the main ones on the first page are in Arabic.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
or from the Doom Forum.
So what else you got?
Well, there was a story that you talked to me about earlier this week, and I thought this was curious because of the way the woman who's claiming to have the evidence is approaching its disclosure. And this was the apparent revelation or the alleged revelation of DNA proof of the existence of Bigfoot.
Oh, yes, yes.
This was...
Ketchum? Is that her last name?
Dr. Melba S. Ketchum,
yes,
of DNA Diagnostics claims to have analyzed 111 specimens during a study that were purported to be Sasquatch hair, blood, mm-hmm, skin, and other tissue types. She says that individuals at 34 different hominin research sites in 14 U.S. states and 2 Canadian provinces submitted samples for the study. Now, just to define the term, hominin is different from hominid.
Mm-hmm.
Hominid is biped.
Yeah.
Hominin is a
human.
Yeah, basically another form of human.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Homo something.
Right. So the review has been published. This is supposedly a 5-year study and put out in the journal called the De Novo Journal of Science, which, when Sharon did some research on this, discovered is actually owned by Dr. Melba S. Ketchum.
Well, it's hard to pin that down. She had, there was another website attributed to her,
mm-hmm,
that was, what was it called? Sasquatch DNA or something like that. But it had originally had a page up there where she was saying that because she was having so much difficulty getting her paper published by other journals, mm-hmm, that she had bought a well-known, well-respected journal and simply online journal and simply changed the name,
mm-hmm,
so that she would not affect the previous peer-reviewed articles. It's very, very strange. But the publication, Volume 1, Issue 1, which, mm-hmm, is available there now, is only dedicated, the only article is hers.
Hmm.
And it's really, really strange. I have to give kudos to Sharon Hill, who is an investigator who was quoted, I think, at several websites, including Huffington Post. And this gal is the one who tracked a lot of this information down. The page where Dr. Ketchum had mentioned the purchase of the online journal and then changing the name, which, by the way, on one location on the journal is called De Novo,
right,
and on another is called Devono. So I'm
okay.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems to have stock photographs on there, stock images. There are a lot of things about it that raise red flags. Let's just put it that way. If you look at the page dnadiagnostics.com, which is the webpage for her lab, mm-hmm. She talks about, or whoever put the website together, talks about how this is a well-respected lab that has actually patented or patent pending a type of genetic evaluation test called VeriSNP. They do human forensics, human paternity tests, animal parentage verification, trait testing, disease diagnostics, mitochondrial DNA testing, going on and on and on. She says that she has testified at various court cases. She is a member of many, you know, well-known organizations within her field. She sounds like, online, she looks like mm-hmm. a legitimate scientist.
Mm-hmm.
However, the approach that she is using for publication of her research on the Sasquatch is so amateurish. It's laughable.
Yeah. Not that we hold peer review to be the ultimate arbiter of
no, but
true
that's
science.
The way it's done. True science is reviewed by peers, and one of the reasons for that is to take a look at the samples you're using,
mm-hmm.
what your methods are, what the data, how you arrived at that, what your conclusions are. They really valid conclusions based on the data.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have really good? Brain is not working.
Controls.
Thank you very much. Controls in place. There are specific ways to conduct science, and these rules have to be followed. The paper is put together in a very strict way so that you can easily skim it and know what was taking place. But you also do this so that another lab can come along and try to replicate your findings.
Right.
And if you can't do that, then they're essentially worthless.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a one-off, it's worthless. But my biggest question is, where did she get the samples? Where did all these people come up with Sasquatch that they know for a fact?
Right.
Because it's not that she's saying she's proven Sasquatch exists. What she's saying is she's got Sasquatch samples,
mm-hmm.
and she's proving that it's a type of hominin.
Right. The abstract says, and by the way, not to derail the conversation, but the reason I was smiling so broadly while you were going through that very necessary explanation of the process, when you said paternity testing, I just had this image of a large Geico caveman type guy sitting in a chair on the set to the Maury Povich show and some woman yelling at him, oh no, you didn't! You know, that kind of thing.
Holding a little baby
that's right.
You know, got really long arms and lots of hair.
Doing the testing to determine.
Not mine.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I'm totally not responsible.
Smoking a cigarette.
The abstract says 111 samples of blood, tissue, hair, and other types of specimens were studied, characterized, and hypothesized to be obtained from elusive hominins in North America, commonly referred to as Sasquatch. DNA was extracted and purified from a subset of these samples that survived rigorous screening for wildlife species identification. Mitochondrial DNA sequencing, specific genetic loci, L-O-C-I?
Hmm.
Loci, okay. Loci sequencing.
Or loci. It all depends on.
Forensic short tandem repeat testing, whole genome single nucleotide polymorphism, bead array analysis, and next generation whole genome sequencing were conducted on purported Sasquatch DNA samples gathered from various locations in North America, and so on. And the conclusion is that she's got something unique here, something that is what
that
she calls
novel. That she's saying
novel.
Descends from a human female and
right.
a male of unknown origin.
Right, the guy with the cigarette on the Maury Povich show. That totally wasn't me. I'm not the father.
And over on the at the end, there's this little gray alien laughing.
Now, we're having some fun with this, but, you know, the irony of all this is that is that who knows? But she may actually be onto something here.
Well, that's just it. But the sad thing is, because of the way she's decided to approach publication,
right. You got to pay to get the extract.
You have to pay $30 to get the abstract, which is crazy. I mean, those with it, to get the abstract, you have to pay. To get the report, I think you have to pay. But it's very common to be able to read an abstract at a scientific journal, and then you have to either be a member or pay a very modest fee mm-hmm. to get a copy of the entire report. Yeah, it's usually relatively small.
Yeah.
You only have to pay big time if it's some kind of super important, like the Human Genome Project or something. Yeah. I don't know. I would love to think that a woman scientist out there is breaking new ground, but where'd she get the samples? Right. Can you read again what assumed to be, purported to be? What was the phrase?
Let me go back to open the other tab again. 111 samples of blood, tissue, hair, and other types of specimens were studied, characterized, and hypothesized. Hypothesized to be obtained from elusive hominins.
Hypothesized.
Right.
That's the operative word.
Right. In an interview with the website Red Orbit, and I'll put a link to this so you can read the article for yourself, PIDradio.com, Dr. Ketchum told Red Orbit that the findings definitively prove the existence of a surviving hominin in North America. Quote, clearly, non-human hair washed thoroughly, as is accepted procedure in forensic science, to remove contaminants by two laboratories with two techniques, yielded human mitochondrial DNA sequence in all 111 samples in the study. 30 samples were taken past the screening to yield human mitochondrial haplotypes, with 20 of those being entire mitochondrial genomes, 16,500 bases long. Since species identification depends on the mitochondrial DNA in forensics, this clearly placed the samples in the family Homo, i.e. hominin. Screening by sequencing with universal primers would also have shown contamination if it had been there. She said the biggest surprise that she discovered during the team study was that they existed. They being apparently the novel hominin.
So why isn't she publishing at genetic magazines?
Well,
there are lots of them. Why isn't she publishing at anthropology sites?
It could be for the same reason that anyone who tries to publish a paper on intelligent design is.
I realize that, but by giving interviews to Red Orbit and Coast to Coast, she's not doing herself any good.
Her credibility is not well served in that regard. But her claim again is that they have found a the DNA evidence of the legendary creature Sasquatch, and they said that it originated from a human relative split off from the Homo sapiens tree about 13,000 years ago.
You know, if she is genuine in her beliefs, she may be publishing what she believes to be true, mm-hmm. but at the risk, honestly, of her professional reputation.
Yeah. So there is some risk there.
She may lose her. I mean, her business, DNA diagnostics, that's how she makes her money, my guess is. Mm-hmm. And she may find herself with fewer customers.
Yeah. You could just see that in a court of law with a defense attorney. Oh, so you used the Bigfoot lab, huh?
Yeah.
Well, we'll watch this story, but this was an interesting development that popped up this week on Valentine's Day.
Oh. I got roses and strawberry bread. From my honey bunny.
Well, it's the least I could do, seeing as I was out singing, Valentine's to other people all day long. The barbershop chorus that I sing with does, as many of them do around the country, the Barbershop Harmony Society will sell singing Valentine's, typically as fundraisers for the groups themselves. In our case, we take the proceeds once we subtract the cost of those boxes of candy and donate the proceeds to area high school vocal music programs so that, schools are always in need of funding, and especially now when the economy's taking a hit. And
I was just suddenly picturing four Bigfoot, guys in tuxedos.
Let me call you Bigfoot. I forgot your name. Anyway.
Well.
Much going on here. At Radford University on the East Coast, it's in Radford, Virginia, strangely enough, they're offering an independent study course in communicating with the dead.
Oh,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's such a bad idea.
Yeah. It is held in a bedroom on campus that's been converted into a seance chamber, and students for class credit can be are going in there and calling up the dead. It's an independent study course.
So do you fail the course if you fail to, you know, bring up somebody dead?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, do you not get credit if you don't come back with some credible evidence? It is the mind chamber that there has been called the psychomantium, M-A-N-T-E-U-M, the psychomantium. Set up inside an old apartment complex turned into the Religious Studies Advising Building at Radford University.
It's psychomantium, often called mirror gazing.
Oh, I remember hearing about it, sounded familiar to me. Remember hearing about this when I was in high school. People who said, you know, you look in the mirror and you say some phrase over and over again, and you're supposed mm-hmm. to, yeah, okay,
yep. Set up to communicate with the spiritual realm, reflective objects, mirrors, or surfaces that are such as blood or water. And this is actually how Nostradamus did his. He looked down into a little cauldron, a bowl shaped. Uh-huh. With water, that was filled with water.
Right, right, right. Huh. Well, Professor of Religious Studies at Radford said the people are coming in here using an ancient ecstatic teaching that's been used in ancient Greece and elsewhere to contact the dead.
Mm-hmm.
So, wonderful. Students, come on in. We'll teach you how to engage in necromancy. Oh, don't pay any attention to what that says there in the book of Deuteronomy and Leviticus. Forget all that.
Let's see. The room is set up to optimize psychological effects such as a trance. Its key features are low light or near darkness, flickering light, and a mirror. The dimness represents a form of visual sensory deprivation, a state of apparent blindness. This is just really creepy. And I suppose if you're a psychologist, is this part of the psychology department?
No, religious studies.
Oh.
Yeah, it seems like a bad idea.
Yes.
For Christians, of course, I presume Jews as well, because this is...
Sam's just told me that I left the light on in his closet.
Oh, thank no.
Sam. Wow.
Yeah. No psychomantium in there. Can't have lights on in the psychomantium. The closetarium. All right, Sam's had enough of this discussion. It's freaking him out.
You want to go outside?
I love you. All right, well, we'll continue with tap dance. As long as we're on the subject of religion, might as well talk a little bit more about the other big news. Of course, as we discussed with Chris Putnam last week, co-author of Petrus Romanus, the final pope is here. Preparations are being made in Rome for the naming of the next pope. The hope apparently is that they can have the new pope in place before Resurrection Sunday, Easter Sunday, which would be the last Sunday in March, which is the 24th. They are saying now that the new conclave could begin before the Ides of March, which would be March 15th. There are a lot of politics that go into this, obviously, because the Holy See is a position of great temporal authority, not just religious authority. So it will be interesting to see what goes on. And I don't pretend to be any kind of an expert when it comes to the political machinations behind the scenes in the Vatican. But there are some... there are some interesting things developing, sort of tangentially related to what's happening with the Pope, and that is the appointment of a new bank president for the Vatican.
Yes? Oh, sorry, I just thought I'd come in here really quickly while I wait for him to come back to the door. Just wanted to make sure that you mentioned the various stories about his health that have been coming out since his announcement to resign. One of those being that when observed by a friend. Recently, he thought the Pope was deaf in one ear and blind in one eye.
Oh.
That blind in one eye thing is interesting.
Yeah. Well, occult significance there, and that's not an area of my expertise either, but I'm at least aware that there is. Let's see, I'm blind. One eye. Wait till Sharon gets back, and we'll talk more about that. But the Vatican Bank has been the subject of a lot of controversy and scandal for decades. And the gentleman, a German lawyer who's been named to head up the Vatican Bank, a fellow named Ernst von Freiburg, happens to be a member of the Order of the Knights of Malta, which is a group within the Vatican that has wielded a considerable amount of political power around the world, not just in Rome. Some of the controversy stemming from the fact that he's chairman of the executive board of the German shipyard Blohm and Voss, which produced warships for Nazi Germany during World War II. Now they say they're totally into just, you know, repairs and building yachts. No more. We are doing a few gunships for the German Navy, but aside from that, nothing to worry about. So anyway, Ernst von Freiburg, German lawyer, he's going to remain as chairman, by the way, of the German shipyard when he takes over the Vatican Bank.
I heard you mention the Knights of Malta, and didn't they have a big to-do the Saturday before the Pope announced?
I
think it was their 900th anniversary or something like that.
I'll have to take a look at that. I should have checked that. I wasn't aware of his Knights of Malta connection until just before we went to record the program here.
Celebrates 900th anniversary at the Vatican. February 9th, 2013.
Interesting.
Oh, it's just a coincidence.
So, anyway, I need to do a little more digging on that. We've talked about that once or twice before, but we get to a point where I've stuffed so much stuff into my head that other stuff is leaking out, and I'm forgetting why the Knights of Malta kind of popped into our radar. I seem to remember that they were connected in a roundabout way with the Council for National Policy, but it's a subject that's going to be too complex to try to bring up a few things here while we're on the fly, and.
It rings a bell with me on that.
Yeah, we'll do a little digging on that. That's going on. And again, the new conclave, or the conclave to elect the next pope, could get underway here within the next couple of weeks. They're hoping to get it started before the 15th of March.
President of the American chapter of the Board of Founders of the Knights of Malta. Maybe. I don't know. Yes. You're cute, though, even with stuff coming out of your ears. Most of them are music notes.
Yeah, generally.
Yeah.
That's something to keep an eye on, because, again, the political intrigue that no doubt takes place, probably no different than the political intrigue that takes place anywhere where power gathers. Washington, London, Rome, Moscow, Beijing. I'm sure there's just a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that we will never be privy to.
Well, that's a shock.
I know this is kind of an odd transition, but speaking of political intrigue, we had to talk about that new show that we've discovered on Netflix.
Oh, House of Cards?
Yeah. We talked about House of Cards before, but
it's been redone.
Exactly. That's what we're talking about here. We've watched the original production with Ian Richardson. This is based on a series of novels set in Parliament. And follows the career of Francis Urquhart, who goes from being the chief whip for the Tory party to becoming prime minister, and all of the...
But don't give it any more away in case
all the dealings that lead him to that position of authority. It's been redone, and Netflix is producing it. This is their first original production. Kevin Spacey stars in it and is one of the executive producers.
And they put all 13 episodes up at the same time.
Right.
You can watch the whole first season.
With nary a commercial interruption, which is a cool way to watch programming.
Yeah, now, it's incredibly done.
It is incredibly well done. Now, bear in mind that this is adult entertainment. There are some words you don't want the kids to hear.
And there's some nudity.
There's some nudity. So, I mean, this is definitely aimed at adults, but it's well-written and kind of a fascinating look at power politics from the inside. I'm glad that they transplanted the series from the UK to America. When I first saw House of Cards, oh, we're going to have to endure Kevin Spacey doing an English accent. No, he plays Francis Underwood, Frank Underwood, a congressman from Gaffney, South Carolina, which is funny because my sister lives about the next town over.
That's true.
Yeah. And the Peachoid, which is the giant water tower shaped like a peach, features in one of the episodes.
So if you know about that, you'll especially appreciate that episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. Catch it if you've got a Netflix subscription. It's one of the streaming opportunities, streaming options.
But not while the kids are in the room.
It's tremendous. No, 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 no. Not while the kids watch this late at night when the kids have gone to bed or when they're over at grandma's.
So good stuff there.
You know the story coming out of South Africa, Oscar Pistorius, the Blade Runner, the athlete, who is alleged to have, his girlfriend is dead. He's alleged to have killed her. He says that he shot her accidentally.
Yeah, right.
Many times. Through the bathroom door. And that there's a bloody cricket bat that has now been mentioned today, and that may be why authorities have chosen to charge him with murder. So this is really a big story for South Africa, and in, and those who follow the Olympics and the Paralympics, they're very familiar with the Blade Runner. He's so called because he was born without fibulas, which are these smaller bones in the lower leg, and because of that, when he was about a year old, he had both legs amputated a little bit below the knee, and his parents encouraged him to be athletic despite that. He did so, and when he got older, he fell in love with running, and he's won just about everything. I mean, he very rarely fails to win. He has those very interesting lower... extremities that are used for running. I'm sure he doesn't wear those every day. They look like blades. I mean, they're just sort of a bent piece of resilient steel or some sort of metal. Fiberglass, I'm not really sure what they're made of. They are made by, I think, a Swedish or a Norwegian company. And, boy, he flies on those things. So much so that he actually went from the Paralympics to the Olympics. And the other runners were angry about it because they felt he had an unfair advantage.
I see what you're saying. Whatever those blades are, curved metal. I think there's some sort of alloy that have some flexibility to them. And
the ones he originally got actually broke. So this is it's like being on springs.
But they are reporting. You know, the Guardian in the UK, among other news sources, reporting the bloodied cricket bat. So that kind of That would be difficult to explain. I mean, his claim was that he thought she was an intruder and that he shot her in the middle of the night, thinking that he was defending the home, his home, against a burglar or you know, some sort of attacker. But the cricket bat, which is like a baseball bat but larger or flatter on the one side, that's a little difficult to explain.
Because
you have to actually get close.
Well, that's assuming it's her blood. It is possible that she was defending herself against him and that it's his blood on the cricket bat. In which case, he surely saw her if she was close enough to hit him with a cricket bat.
City Press newspaper, according to The Guardian, reports that a cricket bat covered in blood was found at Pistorius's home, and that's the central piece of evidence against him. Citing sources close to the investigation, the paper said that the model, her name was Steenkamp, I think. Anyway, that her skull was crushed.
So that doesn't sound like a bullet.
No.
You know, the reason I bring this up is not just because he is a celebrity within the field of sports, but also because it's South Africa. South Africa is a powder keg in many ways, and we have it on good authority that, and I've looked this up to confirm it. I've received emails from friends that we have there, and I have looked it up. Indeed, there are rumors and have been floating around for many years that when Nelson Mandela dies, that there is a plan in place for a black-on-white war to take place.
Oh.
And in fact, it is said by some, and I don't live in South Africa, I can't attest to this personally, but what I have read in many spots online is that those who live in South Africa and are white, they have been threatened sometimes if the African African American, if the African South African feels that he is being unfairly treated, he will use that as a threat and say, well, you know, when Mandela dies, we're going to take you all out. I hope there's nothing to that, because it reminds me way too much of Rwanda, which was actually black on black crime.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It was the two main tribes that were at war with each other and continue to be so. Africa has been a political pawn in Western hands for a long time in this Western chess game that we're playing.
Mm-hmm.
And I fear that the anger at the Western world, at the white world, may, because Mandela in many ways has preached peace.
Mm-hmm.
And it is possible that if he dies, and he's very fragile, he's much older, there have been rumors for the last 6 months, off and on, that Mandela is dead. I see it online all the time.
Hmm.
With this going on, with Pistorius's trial in the headlines as well, it doesn't reflect well on whites in general. Now, his girlfriend was Dutch. I mean, she was white.
Mm-hmm.
Had she been African,
mm-hmm.
Lord help us. But you know, either way, she is dead. So that's the whole reason I bring that up, because I think we who live in the United States tend to think that everything that's important happens here.
That's very true. We know far less about the rest of the world. I include myself in this.
Me
far
too.
Less the about
only
the rest
reason
of the world
that
than
I
should.
I am so grateful to any of you who live in other countries,
mm-hmm.
who send us emails or notes on Facebook and just tell us what's going on. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Another aspect of the Pistorius case is that he's been, that they are testing his blood for drugs and for steroids.
Oh.
With the possibility that there may be some sort of drug aspect to this that, you know, has not yet been reported, but we do know that they're testing for that as well.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if he, I'm sorry.
Again, according to this article from the City Press, and I'll put a link to this in the show notes as well, the state prosecutor in South Africa believes he's got a rock-solid case.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, here in the U.S., you know, prosecutors have to be elected, and for political reasons, they may well say things for their own personal gain, whether such is true or not. I mean, the Duke lacrosse team rape case comes to mind, where the prosecutor there took the members of the lacrosse team from Duke University to trial and found out that the whole thing was made up. Not that those young men were paragons of virtue. I mean, they did, after all, hire the stripper for their alcohol-fueled party.
Yes, yes.
But they were not guilty, and there was no evidence, really, to suggest that they were guilty of the crime, just that the prosecutor there was trying to make some political hay out of that particular case. So, Go ahead.
I just want to make sure that we mention this story before we close out today. I know that we have a ways to go, but and that is the story of the coronavirus, the novel coronavirus that is. Honestly, there haven't been that many people who have come down with it, about a dozen, but out of that dozen or so, five have died.
Hmm.
So it appears to be a rather lethal coronavirus. The SARS virus was a type of coronavirus, and it's called that because the shape of the exterior of the virus envelope, it looks like it's wearing a little crown.
Hmm.
This novel virus has now infected, I think it's either the second or the third person within the same family. So they think it is actually communicable from person to person.
Hmm.
It's never, up until last year, it had never been seen in humans before. So there may be something just starting to get traction.
Hmm.
If this were to take off, it could be really bad. I will say that the UK press is really, really getting it out there and playing it up. I don't know if they're doing it justice or if they're just, you know, causing fear.
Hmm.
People in the UK may start wearing little masks soon.
Yeah,
it's the third family member.
I see that, yeah. The Guardian, again, reporting on this, and the question is, according to a blog post at The Guardian, when to push the panic button on something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, coronavirus. In fact, they're referring to it as a SARS-like virus that appears to have originated in the Middle East, according to the Health Protection Agency in the UK.
Well, I think the very first known case was there.
Yeah, 12 confirmed cases worldwide, 4 in Britain, 3 in Saudi Arabia, 2 in Jordan have died. 3 in Saudi Arabia and 2 in Jordan have died. So, but the Health Protection Agency in the UK does not consider the latest case to be an escalation of the problem.
Okay.
No, well, need to panic. Nothing
to
see here.
We're doing giant headlines of it.
Yeah.
But
nothing to see here.
Exactly.
Move along. And meanwhile, south of the border in Mexico, a bird flu outbreak has hit over 500,000 chickens.
Ooh.
H7N3, bird flu virus. In 2012, an outbreak of H7N3 led to the slaughter of more than 22 million hens. So far, this has hit 582,000 chickens, according to Mexico's Animal Health Agency. 7 farms in central Mexico. The number that will ultimately have to be slaughtered in order to contain the outbreak, yet unknown.
You know, this sort of story is easy to dismiss, but if you are a chicken farmer and they come along from the government and say, let's kill all your chickens, well, it doesn't necessarily mean your chickens are sick. It may mean that a chicken in the region or in the neighborhood is sick and they're going to kill everything.
Yeah. Kate Iola, author that I interviewed a couple of times, going back, 6 years now.
Yeah, back to Columbia.
Right. Wrote a novel called Dead Stock, you know, play on the word livestock, in which she outlines a scenario that's pretty frightening when you think about it, because it could have the same kind of economic impact in the United States as the detonation of a dirty bomb in a city. If somebody were to take manure infected with hoof and mouth, and distribute it on a few feedlots in, you know, Kansas, Missouri, Illinois, what have you, and just, you know, Wisconsin, and let that be tracked around. I mean, deer are so prevalent, especially in farming areas, because they kind of like to go through the fields and munch on the corn or whatever, take advantage of the cover provided. They can transmit these diseases, which are very communicable, from farm to farm.
Well, deer can, but so can birds.
Right.
I mean, there are all sorts of critters that land in that field.
And these can be borne by air. And I don't know if you've noticed, driving through parts of Illinois and Iowa, the reason they've got those really big wind turbines up there is because there's a lot of wind moving from west to east. So you start out in Kansas and start this stuff going out there, you could wind up with a situation in which billions of dollars worth of livestock become dead stock. Funeral pyres of cattle and hogs, and could be really a nasty situation. So it's a good book. It's a frightening scenario because you wouldn't consider, you know, some plastic bags full of animal poop to be a weapon of mass destruction. But in truth, it can be. So we keep an eye on stuff like this. Again, not for reasons of fear or to try to spread doom, but just be aware, be smart, and, you know, just be prepared to understand that our strength, our source of strength is not in this world. You know, our hope is not in this world only.
Amen.
So.
But, you know, also these are many things that enter into the economic health of a nation.
Right.
If you lose a lot of your agriculture, your stock's going down, so to speak.
Mm-hmm,
no
mm-hmm.
pun intended.
Yep. But there are, you know, a lot of things of spiritual significance taking place in the world. We haven't talked about some of the darker things that take place in Africa in some time. I did some research on this a while back for a novel I'd started writing and never really got finished, but it was disturbing to see how many cases of, murder how many people were being killed so that their body parts could be used in magical rituals over there, specifically children or people, albinos in particular. And there's another case just reported by the French press agency of a boy in Tanzania who had a hand removed with a machete by three men who wanted to use it as a an item in a magical ritual, there is a belief there among certain strains of the occult that body parts from albinos have certain powers and properties for healing or for, you know, or be used in other ways.
There are really some dark things going on in this world that would shock you.
Yeah,
if you knew about them.
In last month, a child, an albino child in Tanzania, died after attackers chopped off an arm with a machete. Just a few days ago, an albino mother of four had her arm chopped off by men with a machete. Police on Saturday arrested five men after discovering the decomposing limb hidden in a field.
Yeah.
So, and I used to remember what the name of this magical practice was called, and I can't recall it off the top of my head. Again, kind of dark stuff. It's not the kind of thing you want to dwell on very long, but there is an underground economy, almost in.
We should ban machetes.
Yeah. You know, and this isn't the only way this is done. I mean, there is a belief, too, in certain parts of the world and in Africa that a guy with AIDS can be cured by having sex with a virgin. And so there are reports that periodically make it out into the Western world of young children, girls, young girls who are taken and raped by men with AIDS in the hope that they will be healed. And, of course, all that happens is that the young girls are infected. So, yeah, there's some hideous stuff that comes out of that part of the world.
You know, that storyline was in one of the episodes of Apparitions. The notion of healing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway,
I've been looking on, this is why I've had my head down and typing. I've been trying to find, wasn't there a story recently about a group of young people, and I want to say just young girls, but it may have been boys as well, who were exhibiting an illness that was similar to being possessed.
Yeah, in fact, I clipped that article. Let me find it here, because I'm glad you brought that up. I did want to mention that today.
Why can't I find that? I keep putting in
where
the search
was that,
terms. Was it in Leroy someplace?
No, I thought I copied that. It was a type of encephalitis.
Oh, okay.
A type of encephalitis that was affecting young women in, wasn't it on the East Coast?
That's what I thought.
Yeah. A woman describing the sensation as like her brain being on fire.
Yes, brain on fire. That's right.
Brain on fire encephalitis. Yeah, that's the suggested term from Google. Cases that started popping up last fall, a woman has written a book called Brain on Fire.
Oh, wait a minute. This goes back to 2009. It's in the news again because of her book.
Because of the book, okay.
I remember when that story was floating around, then that's why I wanted to bring it up, because I thought, how odd they were going through this again. Remember, there were school-age girls who were suddenly behaving as if they were demonically possessed. They were, and at the time they thought it was a Tourette's kind of sin illness.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, possibly it was caused only by, you know, an actual organic illness, but I don't know.
Yeah, kind of an odd, a strange disease. Thankfully, the woman who wrote the book has recovered, but it really threw medical professionals for a loop for a while until they were able to get a handle on what was causing it.
You know, it's hard. I want to stay on this for just a second, because it goes back February 10th, 2013. This is this year. This is the article that was at the Daily Mail. It leads with her brain is on fire, neurological condition affecting young women discovered that makes them hysterical, then catatonic. An illness newly discovered by Philadelphia doctors is leaving. That makes it sound as if it's current. Young women dazed, restrained to hospital beds, and finally catatonic. Doctors say it's as if your brain is on fire. then they get a little bit into the book, but the article on the 10th of this month makes it sound as if this is an ongoing infection, as if there are still girls who are catching this. You know, it's the way they wrote it, and it's to make it sound like it's more immediate. They are discussing something that happened back then, but they are saying the illness was discovered in 2007. This article is written as if it is
taking place now.
Exactly.
Yeah, making it seem, well, it's a good writing would get you believing that it's a...
What's interesting is this is called an autoimmune disease. This normally encephalitis is a temporary condition. This is an autoimmune disease, which is a chronic disease. It's called anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis, which causes antibodies to attack the brain, which then causes the brain to swell. Well, yeah, that sounds horrible, actually. Mm-hmm. But I don't understand why it's being treated as it really did. The article, the headline and the lead-in really made it sound as if this is ongoing.
Well, compelling writing gets you to continue to read. If, you know, the article started off, it said, you know, we had this problem 6 years ago, but everything's fine now. It's not likely to get you.
But look, there's a fireball over Russia.
You know, there was something we talked about a while back with, my brain is now seizing up on me, from Israel, and he had suffered a stroke just before we finally spoke to him. Peter Goodgame linked to a lot of his articles, and he's written about...
I know who you're talking
Giants
about.
Giants in the Land.
And, he's living in Canada now, that gentleman?
Don't recall. But he had talked about the desire of the Vatican to acquire rights over the Holy City, specific parts of the Holy City. And apparently an agreement has been reached between Israel and the Vatican. This is being reported. Actually, this was a couple of weeks ago, so we're just catching on to this now. An op-ed in the Arutz Sheva newspaper, not very pleased about this agreement that's been drafted. Israeli authorities have granted the Pope an official seat in the room where the Last Supper is believed to have taken place on Mount Zion. This site is supposedly located above the tombs, or the location, it's believed to be the location of the tombs of Kings David and Solomon.
The place where the Last Supper took place?
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
I was not aware of this either, but apparently this is the result of a long campaign by the Roman Catholic Church to regain religious stewardship over the site of the Last Supper. There are those in Israel who are upset that this was pushed through without any public debate. According to sources, the author of the op-ed piece says the agreement, which is expected to be ratified next June, that would be June of 2013, gives the Pope a special authority over the second floor of the building so that Christian pilgrims will be able to celebrate religious functions there like Pope John Paul did in the year 2000. Now, he was...
Barry Chamish.
Barry Chamish. That's, yes. Thank you.
That's one for me.
So anyway, there are a number of other sites that the Vatican is asking Israel to hand over to its control. 19 in Judea and Samaria and 28 in Jerusalem. Catholic Church wants to discuss some properties on the Mount of Olives. I can understand why Israelis would be a little bit concerned about this. Hard for us to understand looking in from the outside as people raised in a predominantly Christian culture, or at least Christianized culture, let's put it that way, to understand all of the backstory, but could certainly understand, I mean, that the political finagling over sites with such religious significance to Jews and to Christians would be a very controversial, very contentious. So anyway, something to keep an eye on. Apparently, a deal has been struck for at least this one site, the site of the Last Supper.
BarryChamish.com, by the way, BarryChamish.
Yeah.
In case you want to go there. He has not, it doesn't look like he's published a new article since May of last year.
Yeah, well, you have to dig into that. I know, again, Peter Goodgame at his website was pointing up Barry's articles. But yes, it's been a number of years since we've spoken to him, probably since 2005.
Yeah.
Or six. Or
six,
yeah. We moved in 06, and I know we didn't talk to him after we left St. Louis. So, but he does have a new, relatively new book, released in December of 2012. So,
yeah. If you go to redmoonrising.com, which is Peter Goodgame's website, you will find some articles by Barry and others that actually mention Barry's opinions. I'm seeing one article here called Vatican Agenda, which is actually by Joel Bainerman. But it, how does the Vatican view the legitimacy of Israel's claims to Jerusalem? Israel's claims to Jerusalem.
Well, yeah, lots of stuff.
I think as Christians, we just assume, okay, well, don't you get it? It's in the Bible, which I'm not laughing at that because I doubt the Bible. I absolutely believe it. I do believe Israel has every right to Jerusalem. It's just amazing how, because I grew up a Christian, how I find it astonishing that anyone would have another opinion. And yet most of the world has another opinion.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so when we look in from the outside on events like this and not even taking into account, I hadn't even mentioned yet, you know, what, you know, the Palestinians and Muslims in Jerusalem might think about this political agreement. I don't know where this is located relative to the new city or the old city. I don't know, you know, who would nominally be in control of this. So, yeah, there are all sorts of things that we, looking in from our little spot here in the center of the United States, kind of insulated from the rest of the world, how this is really perceived over there.
When we talked with Chris Putnam last week, one of the things that really surprised me in the conversation, and if you've not listened to that interview yet, please do so. It's incredible. One of the things that surprised me so much was that Benedict XVI is not as conservative as I thought he was. He's presented as being so conservative that he sort of grates on the nerves of those around him. But the truth is, he is very liberal. He believes in universal salvation.
Apparently, yeah. He was wrote in glowing terms, as did John Paul II before him, about the works of Pierre
Teilhard de
Chardin. Again, mangling the name. 8 years of French, and that's what I come up with. I spent some time over the weekend looking into it. I need to do more, but I found a forum for Roman Catholics, you know, people to discuss theological issues, and they were talking about, or you know, there was some discussion of de Chardin and what did it mean that Pope Benedict and Pope John Paul before him were praising his work, and some had said, well, you know, the guy was a heretic, and others said, well, why? I mean, you know, what's the big deal about all this? So it's interesting that
he believes in a cosmic Christ, or believed. He's long dead.
He knows the truth now.
His beliefs were more in line with Ray Kurzweil than with Christ
and with Eastern.
Yes,
theology.
very much so.
Kurzweil is basically angling for the same goal. He just wants to do it with massive computer power.
Yeah.
Turn the universe into a giant supercomputer.
Upgrade us all.
Yeah. Along those lines, saw a story this week about how Autodesk, which is one of the company that makes the preeminent CAD software, AutoCAD, is announced that they are one step closer to developing a system for printing synthetic organs. Human organs, replacement organs.
Yes, 3D printing is not something you're going to see on everyday news, but the fact is that it is becoming so common that there are now desktop 3D printers available.
Right.
If you want to print, say, a piece for your washing machine, you just go online, find the 3D CAD software, and which will interpret it to tell your machine, which has to have the right sort of source material in it, but it will it will print out a little cog for your washing machine.
There are companies,
for your vacuum cleaner.
Companies doing that now to print custom parts for classic motorcycles and automobiles. You know, vehicles that you wouldn't find a part on the shelf at your local Napa.
And soon they will be, if they're not already, they'll be printing custom corneal transplants.
It is almost the Star Trek replicator.
Almost,
yeah,
yes.
You just tell it, okay, I want a cup of hot chocolate. It just, out of whatever primordial goo it has in its source tanks, will...
We recycle everything.
Exactly. We'll come up with the necessary molecular components and generate the 3D, okay, there's your cup of hot chocolate.
Yeah.
Except they're doing it with organs and what have you. And of course, you get to that point where you can print a replacement kidney or a liver with no fear of rejection. Well, you're just one step closer to living forever. So that is the ultimate goal. And I mentioned that because Autodesk is one of the companies that is a financial supporter, along with other companies like Google, of Singularity University. So
I see. Well, you will be ahead in the jar, honey.
That's right. And we'll be talking about such topics at the Chicago Summit 3 coming up in April. That will be April the 5th and 6th. At the the Westin Hotel in Lyle, Illinois. That's one of the southwest suburbs. The website to find out more is chicagosummit.net. But other speakers on the besides us, Russ and Shelley Dizdar, Ellie Marzulli, Rob Skiba, Tom Dunn of the Josiah Project, Doug Woodward. I'm coming up with all these from memory, and I'm hoping to get the website up before my memory reaches its limit here, because I don't want to leave anybody off the list. Doug Hamp. I got them all but one. All but Doug Hamp.
Honey, you have the best memory.
Well, some days. When you talk about the 1969 Chicago Cubs, I can remember the entire starting batting order in order.
And our good friend Sam Miller will be there, too.
Doing the DVD, right. So
exactly. So if you can't make it, then, you know, you will be able to purchase the DVDs later on.
That's right. The topic will be DNA and the physics of God, design, the corruption, and the future of human DNA. Sharon will be speaking on her area of expertise. I'll be talking about the singularity. And
our good friend Bigfoot will be there presenting his paper.
Subtitled, Move Along, Nothing to See Here.
I wasn't there that night. I know. I never met her.
Link in the show notes at PIDradio.com. And until next time, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. PID Radio is a production of the PID Radio Network, a division of Gilbert House. Please visit our website at PIDradio.com, where you'll find show notes and links to connect with us on Twitter and Facebook. We wish to thank all those who help undergird and underwrite our ministry through prayers, feedback, and donations. To contact us directly, email us at radio@peeringintodarkness.com. Opening music adapted from The Alchemist's Tower by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Closing music, New Day Coming by Steve Grace, stevegrace.com. Content, copyright Gilbert House, and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derives 3.0 Unported License. For more information, see creativecommons.org.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out.